Good morning. I hope you all are doing well. If you are fortunate to have a class tomorrow morning at around 8:40, which includes the Thursday morning lab, there's going to be a fire drill, I just found out.
Woo-hoo!
So around 8:40 in my class tomorrow, or in whatever class you have, if you have a class at 8:40, we'll all walk out of class and go down to the farthest parking lot next to the busy road. Hope we'll just take a few minutes, but I did want to give you a heads up about it because I just found out about it myself. All right. We are talking about how to name compounds, and the importance of the different compounds is really important. So H2O, H2O2, quite different. We saw HGCl and HGCl2 on Monday, so it's pretty important. There's two types of glue that holds atoms together. And one type of glue is called ionic bonding. And in ionic bonding, you have to have positives and negatives next to each other. And that attraction between the positive and negative is actually pretty strong. In lab this week, we'll talk about both types of glue, the ionic as well as the covalent. But right now, I want to talk a little bit more about the ionic type. And when you have positives and negatives, there's special terms for the positive ion and the negative ion. And a cation is something that has an overall positive charge. And if you look right here, this is an example of the formation of a cation. First you have sodium, and sodium on the periodic table is number 11, and that number means 11 protons. But in a neutral atom, you'll have just as many negatives as you'll have positives. So 11 electrons for 11 protons. And sodium, as we're going to see, loves to form a plus one charge ion. And to do that, it's going to lose one of the electrons. So you can see that over here, we still have the 11 protons in the middle, so it's still sodium. Remember, you change that number and you change it to neon or magnesium or whatever. But now we only have 10 electrons. One electron has gone missing. If you're a math person, you can realize that 11 protons with a positive one charge, and initially 11 electrons with a negative one charge, this goes to zero. So in the elemental form of an atom, you always have equal protons and electrons. So this is for neutral sodium. When you make the ion, the cation, still have those 11 positive one protons, but now you only have 10 electrons. So you can see that mathematically it's like 11 minus 10, if you will, all right? That gives you an overall plus one charge, and that's what the sodium ion is. So a positive ion is nothing more than something that has fewer electrons than protons. Positive ions technically are called cations. Now, electrons are really good friends with the nonmetals. And down here on the bottom, you can see a negative ion form. And chlorine loves to take an electron. And you can see that chlorine, which is number 17, has 17 protons and 17 electrons initially. But it doesn't mind taking this extra electron that sodium's kicked out. So the new version, the ion of chlorine, has 17 protons and 18 electrons. This would be called an anion, a negative ion, while a cation would be a positive ion. And you're always welcome to just call them ions if you want to. Cation and anion might be a little bit strange. However, go ahead. Well done. Perfect segue. That's right. This is cheesy, and if you hate cats, you probably want to just shut your eyes on this slide, all right? But yeah, the cations are positive. Cats have positive. Yeah. There's lots of jokes about this. I'm glad you brought it up, man. And I love the chemistry meme cat that pops up a lot and stuff. So I don't have a very cool expression for anions, but you can at least remember them that cats have positive. Cations have positives. Well done. All right, enough nerdiness anyway. So remember that an anion, though, does have more electrons than protons, and that's what gives it its negative charge. And then right here we have an example of a cation, more protons than electrons, so it has a positive charge. So every time you have something positive, more protons than electrons. Negative, more electrons.
When a magnesium atom loses two electrons, it becomes a cation.
Some ions lose more than one electron, some gain more than one electron. Magnesium, we're going to see, loves to lose two electrons. It becomes the magnesium plus two cation.
Fluorine becomes an anion when it gains one electron.
Fluorine, like chlorine, likes to gain one electron, so it becomes a negative one anion, all right? And again, we'll see some rules about how to predict, like, with the how many electrons they'll lose or gain and stuff like that.
I wonder if it has to do with the replacement on the periodic table.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's right. Yesterday in lab, or today or tomorrow in lab, if you haven't had it, we're going to see some rules and stuff. I'll show you a new version of them here, but yeah, that's exactly it. The periodic table, the power of it.
You said the elemental forms on the periodic table are all neutral, right?
Yes, that's right. The elemental forms of all the elements are neutral. So like pure iron would have 26 protons and 26 electrons. And magnesium, which comes as a strip, that would be 12 protons, 12 electrons. The helium gas would be 2 protons, 2 electrons. Now, so how do you know how many electrons are lost or gained? So first of all, the metals will always be positive, all right? At least in our class anyway. Metals generally like to lose electrons, and the number of electrons, sometimes you can predict how many electrons it is, and sometimes you can't. So there's basically three sections of the periodic table here, like Caleb said, that you can always know what the charge is on the metal. And those groups where you always know the charge on the metal, groups 1A, groups 2A, and what I call the stairs. Now, on the periodic table, groups go top to bottom. So 1A, these are the alkali metals, all of these want to be positive 1. And in group 2A, the alkaline earths right next door, these all want to be positive 2. You never see, for example, like sodium being positive 2, and we don't really see magnesium being positive 1. They're almost always positive 1 if they're group 1A, or positive 2 if they're group 2A. But there's also this weird set of stairs, and there's these six elements kind of in the middle that also have fixed charges. And use your imagination here a little bit. It's maybe easier. Let me use this. This is probably easier. Yeah. Silver is like the first step on the stairs. So it's like you go up one step. Then cadmium and zinc, that's the second step, so you go up two stairs. And finally, aluminum, gallium, and indium, that's the third step. Everything in group in the first step, which is only silver, positive 1. Zinc and cadmium in the second step, always positive 2. And indium, gallium, and aluminum in the third step, always positive 3. I recommend that if you start with a periodic table, you can actually like color code this in or something like that. So you know which ones are the stairs. You also know which ones then are 1A and 2A. And when you're making compounds, these guys are awesome because we always know what their charge is. For our purposes, zinc is never anything but plus 2, all right, in a compound. It'll always be that, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's a lot of metals that aren't in groups 1A, groups 2A, and the stairs. And those metals I like to refer to as variable charge metals. So if you look on the periodic table, almost all of the B group elements except for the stairs, as well as the lanthanides and actinides, the two rows underneath, and there's a couple of metals under the non-metals, so like bismuth and lead and all of those metals are what I would call variable charge. And honestly, we just can't predict what's going to happen. Somebody asked me yesterday about one, I think it was 10, like what would be the charge? I have no idea. I have a PhD, so yeah, even I don't know what it is. I certainly don't expect you to know. So what scientists use to talk about the charge is a Roman number. So, for example, iron plus 2 and iron plus 3 are very common charges on iron. And we use a Roman numeral to talk about the charge on the iron. So the iron plus 2 we would refer to as the iron Roman numeral 2 ion. And this one right here would be the iron 3 ion. There's other forms of iron besides positive 2, positive 3. And whatever they are, you would just use a Roman numeral to talk about it. So vanadium has many different charges. Tin and lead have different charges, and bismuth, all these kind of things. Pretty crazy. So all of the metals that don't fall in the stairs 1A or 2A, you want to use a Roman numeral, all right? If you're used to, or if you've seen before, like ferrous and ferric, or cupric and cuprous, you will not use that in my class. I'm an inorganic chemist, and I absolutely abhor this crazy nomenclature. It's old school, and I don't want you to use it. I will mark you wrong. So you use the numerals if you have a metal in one of these categories. You'll see it's a lot easier. The ferrous ferric thing, you have to know something about the metal.
Relatively minor. Is there any particular reason that the 3 plus instead of plus 3?
Oh, you can go 3 plus or plus 3. Either way, this is cool. Same thing for the negative ones, too. So, knowing that, what do you think the probable charge is on barium? All right? So, barium, what you need to do is figure out, first of all, if it's a metal, and that answer is yes. And just to review that part, remember that the metalloid line separates the metals on the left from the non-metals. So barium, right here, number 56, is definitely to the left of the line, so it's going to be a metal. So the next thing then, if you want to know the probable charge, we have to figure out if it's a fixed group metal or a variable charge metal. Is barium that going to be fixed or variable? Fixed. Well done. That's right. Groups 1A, groups 2A, and the stairs, we can predict what they are. Group 2A is where barium is, all right? And it's that Roman numeral 2 that you're after for this problem. You want to call it barium plus 2. Barium is almost always plus 2 in compounds. It's very rare. Questions on.
So fixed charges are always positive.
That's right. Well, in metals, all right. In metals, fixed charges are always positive. We're going to see some non-metals here pretty soon, Joseph, that are negative. But the metals, you bet, always positive.
Yeah. So what makes the group the group B ones
have variable charges? Oh, right on. When we talk about electrons at the end of this class, we can start having that conversation. It has to do with how the electrons are stacked together. Give me a few more lectures and we'll knock that one down. Okay. These stairs are weird, I know, and different chemistry instructors do things differently. But man, these six atoms have very, very fixed pieces. So again, in addition to the 1A and 2A, all right, the alkali metals and the alkaline earths, these guys always have fixed charges. And again, you can see it's like a stair step, and the first step, which has only one element, positive 1, these two positive 2, and these two positive 3. So notice here it's weird, and again, some of these things I can't explain either after we have a conversation about electrons. Like why silver is always plus 1, people debate this still, but it is something that's observed. Very, very rare to see like silver as positive 3 or something like that. Now, Joseph asked a really good question about the positiveness, and the metals that are fixed charge will always be positive. But the nonmetals in general have fixed charges, but they're going to be negative because they're the ones that take the electrons in from the metals while the metals are giving up the electrons. So you can see here that here's like some of the general patterns. And generally speaking, to figure out the charge on the nonmetal, you take the group number and you subtract 8. So if you're using my American version of the periodic table, the halogens are group 7A. And 7, that group number, minus 8, you can see how all of these are negative 1. Group 6, oxygen, sulfur, as well as selenium and tellurium below it, 6 minus 8, all of those are negative 2. And over here we have nitride, phosphide is underneath it, arsenide, 5 minus 8, all of those would be negative 3. So these are fixed charge as well, but these are now nonmetals. And, you can see that generally it's 5, the group number minus 8. All right, they're all negative. Also notice here how in chemistry we change these when they're with a metal to an IDE ending. Electrons are the currency of chemical reactions. Like you have to figure out how the electrons are transferring around to see what the products are. And knowing which is the negative side can be really helpful. And when the nonmetals are with metals, the nonmetals are the negative ones, so we give them an IDE ending. So that's why NaCl is sodium chloride, not sodium chlorine, all right? So bromide comes from bromine, nitride from nitrogen, et cetera, et cetera. If you see the IDE ending, that means that side is a little bit more negative than whatever it's paired up with. So let's say that you wanted to know what the charge was on a phosphide ion, all right? So the IDE, again, is just a way to talk about an ion that's negative. What element do you think where does phosphide come from? What element? Phosphorus, that's right. So phosphorus becomes phosphide, nitrogen becomes nitride, etc. Good. Phosphorus and nitrogen, etc., are in group 5. So 5 minus 8. Phosphide should be a negative 3 ion when it's with different things. Any questions? So when you look at all the periodic table, there's kind of like 3 sections to think about when you're making ionic compounds. All right? The 1A, 2A, and the stairs, those are metals. And they're fixed charge. That means predictable, and that's good in science a lot of times. The charge will always be positive. Magnitude for 1A and 2A is equal to the group number, but again, those stairs go positive 1, positive 2, positive 3, so that's why it says mostly there. But the nice thing is we know those charges all the time, at least in our Chem 200 series. 5A, 6A, 7A, and the nonmetals, those are also compounds where we know their charge all the time. The charge is always going to be negative. It's the group number minus 8. So that's why chloride is negative 1. Group 7 on our periodic table for America, minus 8, negative 1 charge. But you do change the chlorine to chloride. The IDE becomes important because you can tell which one is which. But there's a lot of metals, like we talked about, that aren't in this section, and because they're metals, they're not nonmetals. So for those, we need to have the Roman numerals. And that Roman number just talks about what the charge is. The variable charge metal is most of the transition metals, lanthanides and actinides, a couple of the metals under the nonmetals. There's one beast in this section that we just have to deal with, and I always feel bad talking about this, but most of what we've talked about so far have been monatomic ions. So mono means one atomed ion. So for example, chloride is Cl negative 1, sodium ion is Na plus 1, so single individual atoms. There are, though, these groups of atoms, all right, and they come together, and they're actually amazingly stable. The common one that I'll talk about in lab coming up, or I talked about yesterday, is nitrate. And nitrate is a combination of one nitrogen and 3 oxygen atoms, so 4 atoms total. And if you sprinkle on one additional electron, you end up making the nitrate ion. And the nitrate ion is super stable, All right, it's actually so stable, it's hard to get rid of when it's made. If you hear something with nitrate, this is an example of a polyatomic ion, and there's thousands of them, all right? We're just going to look at the more common ones, but you kind of have to start thinking about memorizing them, and I hate using the M word, and I, as an instructor, apologize to you for saying the M word, but I don't know a better way to do this, and it's going to pop up all the time. So what I mean by memorize is I recommend that either virtually or in the real world, you get some kind of a flashcard system. And they have apps for this for your phone, and you can use regular flashcards if you want. But like on one side, write nitrate, and on the other side, write NO3-1. And that way, every time you see nitrate, you'll say, aha, it's NO3-1. And if you see something like sodium nitrate, and you need to turn it into a formula, you'll know what this is. And so when you're waiting for your friend to get out of class, or you're waiting for your mom to pick you up, or I mean, whatever, you can just flip through some of these, or virtually, I'm still kind of old school. In the lab we're doing this week, there's a list of the polyatomic ions I would like you to know/memorize. So check that out. There are some patterns. We'll talk a little bit about them here. And also in your companion, there's an interesting thing on polyatomic ions and acids, and there's a little learning mnemonic you can use if these are weird to you. But start looking at this, all right? This is going to be important. This is something I want you to know.
Yeah. So that's all the ones we need to remember.
Cool. The list I want you to know is in the lab this week, the nomenclature lab.
So it's different than that.
Yes. There's a few more. Not that many. If you know those, man, then honestly, you should be good all the way to the end of your chemistry career. So yeah, it's a good call. There is a list. It's in the nomenclature lab. It's different than this list. This is just something I got from the table. Yeah, see?
So I'm wondering what you mean when you say stable for an ion. So I was thinking of when something's stable, it has a full amount of electrons.
Cool. So full amount of electrons is going to really start varying. So like a sodium ion missing an electron is more stable than elemental sodium, all right? It's something that will exist. Like the sodium ion runs around in our water. Nowhere on the earth do you have elemental sodium. So some ionic forms are more stable than the neutral versions they come from. And that's something we're exploring in this class, yeah. There's levels of stability that you see in ionic forms that you don't see in the elemental parts. And this whole class is basically about how to figure out when things are stable or not, and we'll explore that. So you've asked a pretty deep question, and all the way through Chem 223, we're going to keep answering that slowly but surely. So just hang on. Good. Yeah, great question. This little pattern right here is important, I think, for a couple of reasons. A lot of the polyatomic ions, more than two-thirds, are oxygen-containing polyatomic ions. So if you look at this list right here, all of these have chlorine, and all of them are a -1 charge. But what changes is the number of oxygens, all right? If you see a name with an ATE or an ITE, that's one hint about finding out that that polyatomic ion has oxygen. So look, here's chrome 8, ATE, permanganate 8, all right? And here's nitrite, stuff like that. ATEs and ITEs mean oxygen-containing species. In the companion, in the handout, it talks a little bit more about this pattern. The ATE form is supposedly, going back kind of to what Zeke said a little bit, the ATE form is supposedly the most stable. So you see chlorate, for example, a lot more than you see chlorite or perchlorate. If you know which one is the ATE form, then adding an oxygen means you add a per to the front. So perchlorate has one more oxygen than chlorate, the base version. On the other hand, the ITE version has one less oxygen than chlorate, than the ATE. So So chlorite has one less oxygen than chlorate. And you can probably see that the two less oxygens makes the hypochlorite version. And this pattern is followed. But what is weird here is that not all of the ATEs have three oxygens. So sulfate down here, sulfate is the most common form, the most common polyatomic with sulfur. And one less oxygen than that would be sulfite. So it's a relative pattern. It's not that all the ATEs have three oxygens, although a lot of them do. But you can then use this kind of minus one oxygen as chloride kind of pattern to kind of make a little bit better sense of it. When you look at the list in the nomenclature lab, at first it's like, Russell, what are you doing, man? But using these patterns, I think, will help a lot to make it a little bit easier. Yes?
Would there be just a magnate?
Cool. Using this pattern, it's totally reasonable to have, like, you'd have like an MnO3 minus one, but Eric, I've never heard of that before. So I honestly don't know why this is permanganate. It must be an older kind of nomenclature and stuff that I'm used to. Good. But in theory, yeah, if someone creates the manganate ion, aha, manganate would have one less oxygen than permanganate. You should be able to use this pattern to predict what's going on. Good. Okay. Which of these polyatomic ions probably does not contain oxygen? Now, again, by looking at the name here, you should be able to figure out the ones that have oxygens and the ones that don't have oxygens. Do the ATE polyatomic ions usually have oxygens? You bet. Sulfate, nitrate, and chlorate. So do the ITEs. All right, so hypoiodite, it was going to have it. ATE, ATE, cyanide. You've probably heard of that one, man. Cyanide, Cn minus 1, does not have any oxygen with it. And again, it's not cyanate, which is a different whole polyatomic ion, but cyanide, no ATE and no ITE. So often, this will help you to figure out what's going on. Cyanide is an example of a polyatomic ion that doesn't have oxygen. Cool. Any questions? Yeah.
Where is, so just as a random question, why does cyanide do bad stuff?
Cool. That has to do with the reactivity of cyanide, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in Chem 223. For right now, just realize it's really good about getting into our bloodstream. Right. It's small, very negative, and hard to dislodge when it's done. Yeah.
I thought when there's a hypo, that means there's no oxygen.
So what you need to look at is not the hypo right now, but the ITE. And in the stuff we're looking at right now, ITE means oxygen. Hypoiodite, hypo something I, means one less oxygen than just the something I. So there's an iodite and a hypoiodite. Hypoiodite does have one less oxygen than the iodite, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's devoid of oxygen. It's like a less thing. Good question. All right. Oh, yes. Nick the camel. Now, if you're like, oh, Russell, fascist, you know, memorize things and stuff like that, I want to introduce this. Some people love this and some people hate this, and I don't care if you but I want to give you all the things that I can think of that might make a little bit of help. This silly expression can be useful when you want to know the ATE form, the base form of the polyatomic ions. Nick the camel brat ate icky clam for supper in Phoenix. And you're like, okay, I think you've lost it now, Russell. Well, this is actually a little mnemonic to help you figure out what's going on. Now, nitrate has a nitrogen, and Nick of the Nick the Camel Brat, et cetera, begins with N. Notice here how the first letter is the central atom in the polyatomic ion. And notice here how when you look at the word Nick, the red letters are consonants and the blue letters are vowels, all right? The number of consonants, non-vowels, not A-E-I-O-U, All right, those represent the number of oxygens. And the number of vowels represents the charge on the polyatomic ion. So if you don't know what nitrate is, but you know Nic, all right, four letters, so that means four atoms in the polyatomic ion. Nitrogen of N is the central one. One vowel, negative one. Three consonants, three oxygens. This actually works pretty well, which is kind of interesting. It's a silly thing. It's something that some people like and some people don't. There's a handout in the companion, and that's something that goes more into detail about this. Sometimes people use crepes for chromate. Anyway, you can go crazy with this, or you can just, you know, say, and I'm going to memorize it. And I don't care which way you do it. I really don't, man. But this is sometimes something that can help. So. Question. A lot of the polyatomics are related to acids. And we're going to introduce the nomenclature of acids here. We're going to talk more about what an acid is later. But an acid is just something with an H on it, and that H is like super reactive. You can think about acids as not like scary things that made Two-Face and Batman, but you can think about acids as being a source of energy in chemistry, all right? So making things happen, sometimes you need a little acid to get it going. HNO3 is an example of an acid. It's nitric acid. And the nitric acid has one hydrogen, which is acidic. And the chemists will always, or at least they should, have the hydrogen listed first because it's so important. And when the acid has done its thing, when the H plus has been dislodged, you end up with that nitrate ion again we've been talking about. So it's like this H is acidic, and when it comes off, you've got a polyatomic ion. Now, not all hydrogens are acidic, and this is something we're going to talk about as we go through the course too. But for right now, if you see an H listed first, that means you've got an acid, so be careful. Another one I want to talk about here real fast is ammonia and ammonium. Now, ammonium is a positive polyatomic ion. Most of the polyatomic ions are negative, nitrates, sulfates, chromates, etc., etc. But ammonium is one of the positive ones. Ammonium is different than ammonia. And ammonia and ammonium are ones you've got to know which is which. Notice how the ammonium NH4 plus 1, NH4 plus 1 has one additional H plus relative to ammonia. Ammonium is a little bit acidic. Ammonia, on the other hand, doesn't have that acidic property. Ammonia at room temperature is a gas. But if you put it in water, it makes ammonium hydroxide. This is what we use during the ID of the unknown compound lab. And it can make then ammonium, which can go on to do interesting things. So just realize ammonia and ammonium are different things. Ammonium is the positive polyatomic. Ammonia is NH3. Here's some other ones and kind of what they look like. These little pictures I'm showing are things we're going to draw in Chem 222. If you've seen Lewis structures, these are basically like a type of Lewis structure. But anyway, phosphates, which sometimes you hear about in water systems, and sulfates, acetates, sulfites. Notice here sulfites and sulfates, all right? One less oxygen, you have sulfite, but the charge is the same and the central atom is the same. So again, these patterns and stuff will help you. And again, this just shows kind of this pattern of oxygens. So if ites have less than eights, if you know what the base system is, then you can figure out what the other one is. Not everything has a per form, like there's no per nitrate. I also don't know of like a hyponitrite, for example. But if you did see that, then you can use this kind of pattern and stuff to figure it out. So spend some time with this. If you haven't seen this before, again, I recommend just like a flashcard kind of system, virtual or real. But again, the Nic the Camel works well for people too, and that's cool. Just make sure that you're ready to rock. If you hear like sodium sulfate, you can figure out then that sulfate is SO4-2.
When metallic zinc is mixed with powdered sulfur and ignited, A powerful reaction takes place that produces zinc sulfide, a compound containing only sulfur and zinc.
When you make an ionic compound in this section, you have to make sure that the positives and the negatives balance out, all right? You don't want to have like a net positive at the end or a net negative at the end. So making zinc sulfide is a good example. Zinc is a positive 2 ion, one of the stairs. Sulfur in group 6, you would go 6 minus 8, so sulfide would be negative 2. So one zinc and one sulfur comes together, and you don't have any leftover charges. I used this idea yesterday in lab, and it's really kind of silly, but you don't want to leave one of the charges hanging. Can I shake your hand? Yeah! This is like a positive 1, negative 1, connections made. But if I'm positive 2, oh, I got this positive charge, it's hanging up. Yeah, that's what I have to do. Thank you. Yeah, it's totally dumb, but you don't want to leave the charges hanging, all right? You want to have something else, like make a connection with it and stuff. So that's really a juvenile way to talk about it, but it does work. And the reason I'm doing it is not just to entertain you. In the world, water and oxygen, stuff like that, they will go after your positive and negative charges. But neutral compounds, where every handshake has a counterbounce, there's no positives or negatives, are a little bit more stable. So the goal is to make things stable, and that's what we're kind of after in this section.
When sodium and chlorine react, the sodium transfers an electron to the chlorine, forming oppositely charged ions. Although the compound has no net charge, its component ions of opposite charge attract each other to form ionic bonds. In turn, these ions are attracted to others, and an ionic solid called a crystal lattice is created.
These positive-negative ionic compounds are super stable because you don't really have just one handshake, a positive and a negative. You actually have, in the other direction, a positive and a negative. Positive and a negative, positive, negative, and even above and below positive, negative, positive, negative. So you have this three-dimensional network of charges interconnected, all right? It's a very strong interaction. And we're going to see that most of the ionic compounds are very hard to break up. They're so stable, all these charges kind of interloping each other. This is ammonium chloride, all right? This is the ionic lattice for how these come together. Ammonium is NH4+, that's the positive, and chloride, the gold ions there, are the negatives. And you can see how, again, it's this three-dimensional lattice. So ionic bonds are much stronger than the other kind of glue we're going to talk about, the covalent bonds. They have an elaborate three-dimensional network, and to break this up, there has to be some kind of special going on. So if you're going to figure out the net number of positives and negatives, you just have to kind of see what you've got. The nonmetals will always be known charges. So if you wanted to figure out what the formula was for calcium fluoride, fluoride, group 7, is going to have a negative 1 charge, like everything in that group. And calcium, a fixed charge metal in group 2A, will always be positive 2. So you can see then how if you had just 1 minus and 2 and 1 positive 2, you add them together, you're still going to have a positive 1 charge. So that's why there's 2 minus 1 fluorides there. That makes all of your charges balanced out. Calcium fluoride is always CaF2. Magnesium and nitrate, you can do similar things. Now, nitrate's one of the polyatomic ions. It's always NO3 with a negative 1 charge. So just like in the earlier example, we're going to need 2 nitrates to balance that 1 magnesium out. Notice that if you have more than 1 polyatomic ion, chemists keep that in parentheses. So Mg parentheses NO3 parentheses 2 shows you that you have 2 polyatomic ions with 1 magnesium. We don't do this kind of thing if it's only a single atom. So CaF2, you wouldn't write Ca parentheses F parentheses 2. Chemists really are lazy, I kid you not. But when there's more than one polyatomic, definitely put that in parentheses. Then finally, if you have a variable charge metal like iron, all right, you have to either know what the charge is on the metal, like if it's given to you, or the name itself will tell you what the charge is. So iron 2 phosphate means you have an iron plus 2, and phosphate is PO4 negative 3. Now when these two come together, notice that 2 times 3 is 6. 6 is like the common denominator. So 6 divided by 2, we're going to need 3 irons, and 6 divided by 3, we're going to need 2 phosphates. So iron 2 phosphate is Fe3 parentheses PO4 parentheses 2. A lot of times, and we'll talk about this in lab, you can use the crossover method. That doesn't work all the time, but if you do, the 3 on the phosphate goes to the iron, the 2 on the iron goes by the phosphate. And again, you have to put the Roman numeral in because you also have iron 3 phosphate as an example. If your iron is plus 3 and your phosphate's negative 3, it's going to be a 1-to-1 ratio of compounds. So this is what we're exploring in lab this week. We'll do more of this in lab today or tomorrow, or we went through it yesterday. Any questions?
The reaction of sodium and chlorine is a vigorous one. We use sand to protect the flask from excessive heat. Then, we fill the flask with chlorine gas. Next, we add sodium, and then a few drops of water to activate the reaction. The reaction produces sodium chloride. When sodium and chlorine react, the sodium transfers an electron to the chlorine, forming oppositely charged ions. Although the compound has no net charge, its component ions of opposite charge attract each other to form ionic bonds. In turn, these ions are attracted to others, and an ionic solid called a crystal lattice is created.
I think as people, we take sodium chloride table salt kind of for granted. You know, you put it on things, or it's just around at tables, you know, what we do. But like Joseph just pointed out, man, there's a lot of energy created when sodium chloride is formed. That flame you saw and the sounds and stuff, that's all the energy that's happening when the NaCl lattice forms. So the green ones on this one are chlorines and the red ones are sodiums. And again, this three-dimensional kind of network builds up. And scientists call the forces that hold ionic compounds together, they call them electrostatic forces. So that's the fancy name for the glue that holds the sodium to the chloride, and it holds the iron plus 2 to the phosphate, etc., etc.
A crystal of potassium bromide has a distinctive shape with perpendicular edges. This shape directly reflects the arrangement of the ions in the crystal lattice. The compound is composed of alternating potassium ions and bromide ions.
Sometimes these forces are strong enough that even in our macroscopic world of objects, you can see the effect. So this is a KBR, I think it's a very, very structured, very rigid, and you actually see that in the crystal form. You can see how it's nice and rigid. Now, not every compound is this cool, but this is a cool one, obviously. So anyway, these electrostatic forces were first described by a scientist named Coulomb, and so this is called Coulomb's Law. It's a way to tell like how strong the force is. And some bonds are stronger than others. And as a scientist who's interested in making reactions happen, it's cool to know the strengths of the interaction so we can see which ones are most likely to occur or which ones are least likely to occur. In physics, you might do a lot with Coulomb's Law. In chemistry, we're just going to kind of interpret this law, but we're not actually going to calculate anything. So in physics, this is what you'll actually see. This is Coulomb's law. The force is the strength between the ions. There's this weird constant, which we don't need to worry about here. But what I want you to look at is this part right here. The force is directly proportional to the number of positive and negative charges. That's what this means, all right? Can I use you again, man? Oh, thanks. Single handshake. Haven't seen you in a long time. Good to see you. Pretty strong, all right? But Caleb says, oh, come on, guys, break it up. You're holding hands too much. I understand. Oh, haven't seen you since last Thursday. Actually, I saw you Monday. Harder for Caleb to break up a double hand. It's going to take more energy, man, because we're really holding on to each other. And if we had a third hand, we could make even a stronger one. Yeah. You'll be my next model. I need you in a second, too. So my apologies and thank you for all the hand-holding, but I hope this shows. A single handshake, strong. A double handshake, haven't seen you forever, even stronger to see. If I had a third hand and you did too, we could have a triple handshake. That would be even harder to break up. So as the number of positive negatives, the number of handshakes goes up, your force goes up too. It's going to be harder to break. But the bottom part, this is the other part. All right, Caleb, you volunteered, man. I appreciate it. Caleb, how's it going, man?
Good.
This is like a positive negative. All right, pretty good. But notice my distance. Caleb, oh, I'm getting farther from you, man. Oh, farther. And he's like adjusting, and I am too. But finally, it's like pinkies only, and then bam, broke it up. Thank you, Caleb. This is the distance form. All right, strong, close to Caleb. Weaker, weaker, weaker. Finally, a so the bottom part, that distance term, as the distance between the positives and negatives goes up, the force goes down, all right? These are the two parts that we're going to use a lot in this class. We're not going to calculate force and newtons and stuff like that. We're just going to use these results. Now, these are some pictures that kind of show what I was doing earlier. Here's my single handshake. I haven't seen you in a long time. Double handshake. I haven't seen you forever. Harder to break up. A positive two, negative two, much more difficult to break up than like a single one. Over here, all right, is the way to show the distance, all right? If the two ions are close, it's pretty strong. But as they get farther and farther and farther away from each other, then your force begins to go down. So bigger atoms aren't going to connect as well as the smaller atoms will. Cyanide is a C and an N that are super, super close to each other. Very hard to break that one up, for example. Question? So, as your charges increase, and in this context, charges is like handshakes, okay? As your charges go up, the attractive forces should also increase. They're going to get stronger. But as the distance between the ions increase, i.e., when I got farther and farther and farther from Caleb, I couldn't shake his hand anymore. As the distance goes up, your attractive force will go down. I'm going to start doing this hand-waving stuff. I apologize. I'm not trying to hypnotize you. No, seriously. What that means is, like, as the ion charges increase, your attractive force will increase. These are proportional changes. On the other hand, as the distance between the ions goes up, then the force is going to go down. So they're inversely related to each other. Again, in physics, you'll actually use Coulomb's law to figure out the attraction between these. We're just going to talk kind of interpreting like how this stuff goes. I'll do more hand waving, probably more shaking of hands, so sorry for you guys. Here's an example of how Coulomb's law really affects us. Sodium chloride has a positive one, negative one charge, a single handshake. Magnesium oxide is a positive two, negative two handshake. The distance between NaCl is about the same as the distance between Mg and O, and we'll talk about this at the end of Chem 221. But notice the change in the melting points. NaCl melts 800 degrees, which is very, very high, but with that double handshake, I haven't seen you forever, it takes a lot more energy to make MgO melt. You have to add more heat energy to make those bonds break up. That positive two, negative two versus positive one, negative one, pretty powerful. Any questions? Yeah.
So is this why compounds with stuff like uranium have a really high
Oh, that can also eat the mass of it too. The mass is also it, yeah. The metal interactions are different. These are more for ionic interactions, but you can kind of interpret that, but put it, the mass for it. All right, have a good day. We'll talk more about covalent bonding on Friday.